This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Dean Bacopoulos. He's the author of a wonderful book called My American Unhappiness, which does have elements of unhappiness in it. It's woven throughout, but did not leave me unhappy having read the book. Hi, Dean. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
No, it's really, hopefully we will have a good time talking about this book because there's a lot of humor here. This is your second book. It's set in the Midwest, specifically Wisconsin. And I know this is a, you know, you're a Midwestern writer or a Midwesterner who writes. And, you know, it seems to be maybe a theme of your work, both your fiction and your nonfiction. You know, you're pretty interested in the Midwestern experience.
Right.
You know, maybe, you know, because I do want to talk about this book in specific terms, but I don't want to, you know, I never want to give away the story. But your main character is a guy named Zeke Pappas, Greek-American like yourself. So there's some biographical congruencies,
sure,
shall we say, in this book.
Sure.
And you also, I know, pointed out that even though you worked at a place called the Wisconsin Humanities Council, and your character Zeke works for something similar, though not the same, you did want to make sure that your colleagues and friends at the Humanities Council did not mistake this book for being about them.
Right, exactly.
But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you use real events and real people in your, you know, in your story, but fictionalize it. I mean, maybe talk about how that works, because a lot of writers purposely don't want to be kind of autobiographical, even in this sort of indirect way, but you're not afraid of doing that at all. You're weaving a lot of your personal experience in imaginative ways into the fiction that you're writing.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to always go to autobiography for source material. I think there's two types of writers, and some do that rather obsessively, and some resist it. And I tend to do that as a choice. In this book, in My American Unhappiness, I definitely did it in a way that was sort of playful and really called attention to it. One of the sort of aesthetic concerns I've had with this project has been the idea that novels are never truly something that can be divorced from the author in this culture. I mean, it's so much about the author, and even the reviews talk fairly extensively about authors, and this idea that the work is going to stand wholly alone is somewhat laughable to me. I admire that, and I don't think I'll do that with every novel. Well, I'll add the autobiographical sort of winks and nods, but I do think there's a purpose to it in this book. There was a sort of choice to call attention to the fact that the obsessions of fictional characters are almost always the obsessions of their authors, and the woes and fears and worries that Zeke Pappas had as the economy falls apart in 2008 are the exact same ones I was dealing with, even though my life situation was different. So the sort of merging of the anxiety of a fictional character with the creator was something I was interested in doing.
But it's tricky, too, because although it may not matter on some level, you know, there's this idea that you don't want to be literal about your experience. And it's hard, you know, for readers. I mean, of course, you know, in a way it doesn't matter. But I think since you've engaged it, you know, it's worth, you know, it's right there for the reader to be thinking about. Because you've said it's obviously set in real life America. You know, there's a lot of, you know, there's talk about the politics and the culture and how people were feeling. So you have to be in the real life. But there's also, you know, there's also exaggeration. You know, I don't think you mean for, let's say, Zeke's particular issues are not necessarily your particular issues in the day to day.
No, not at all. I mean, Zeke is a confirmed bachelor who sees himself as a womanizer, sort of in a false delusional way, but he sort of thinks of himself as quite good with the opposite sex. And I've been married for 14 years. I got married at 21. I never really had a long stretch of bachelorhood to to reflect upon. So there's definitely this big difference between me and this character I've created. But at one hand, I sort of like that mystery in a novel by someone like Philip Roth, or in a novel by Laurie Moore, where you know that there's these authors that you know they're borrowing from life, but they're refusing to tell you what's true and what's not. And I think that adds an interesting element. It doesn't make the book, but I think for some readers, it's sort of a fun game to play. And for me as a writer, it was sort of fun to have an alter ego who I could retreat into, who's preoccupations at their core were similar, but whose situation was so different.
Right. Well, I think that actually is kind of the core strategy of fiction, is to, you know, what I learned when I took a writing class a long time ago would be called indirection. You know, that it doesn't have to be literal to be true, and you can take your reader into a place, as you just described with, you know, with Zeke, the specific things that he is experiencing may not be the same as you experienced, but they are in an indirect way for you to explore things that you're thinking about and that are, you know, issues for you. So, I mean, I think obviously, and Zeke has this, you know, as characteristic throughout of being in denial, you're never quite sure whether he's even got the self-awareness anymore to know when he's in denial, or when he is consciously in denial to the extent that he is living in a fantasy.
I think Zeke does both. I mean, he's delusional, and I think when you're in a state of true delusion, you don't realize it. And I think that he's delusional on several levels. One, I think he's delusional as to how people see him and how they react to him. I think he sees himself as sort of charming and intelligent, and people see him as unstable and possibly crazy at certain moments in the book, at least. And I think he also chooses to ignore details that maybe he's aware of. And I think in terms of his work, this project he's obsessively been doing called the Inventory of American Unhappiness at Work, the money's out, and he believes in this project so passionately that he's not dealing with the reality that it's not a sustainable project, and it's not a project that's going to be funded in the new economy. I think a lot of good liberal intellectuals like myself are dealing with this idea of these institutions and programs we've really valued over the years are not going to get funded anymore or paid for, and we have to figure out how to think of ourselves in a new way, and Zeke's refusing to do that.
Well, and in that way, he stands in for the American public in a lot of ways, who want things to be a certain way regardless of the fact that perhaps those days are over, you know, that, and politicians feed that fantasy, you know, that literally the notion is that people really want, they want to pay no taxes or low taxes, and they want to have all the same services that they always had. And those two things are contradictory. And it's sort of like, you know, in that way, Zeke is, he's really reflecting the overall kind of political, cultural zeitgeist. But it's what people really feel.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that he tapped into this sort of manic optimism we've had in this country, really since Reagan, the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan, which is that we were only going to go up, and that we were going to be that shining city on a hill when we were really building a city on sand, and deregulation and refusing to collect tax revenue and trying to wage wars without paying for them, and propping up banks who are trafficking in money that's not there. All of this stuff is this horrible, unsustainable trajectory for our economy. And everybody on the right and the left was like, as long as things were good, we were having a party. And then in 2008, this horrible hangover began, and it's like waking up from a party horribly drunk, your house is trashed, and refusing to admit that the party might have been a bad idea,
right? Or even that there was a party in the first place.
Right
You know that. Well, the other thing I thought of, and of course I don't know whether you intended this or not, but there are references in the book to George Bush during this period of, you know, there's a certain, I mean, clearly, you know, there's a position in the book which is thinking of Bush as delusional, and maybe In this sort of interesting way, Zeke stands in for Bush, because everything about Zeke you could say about George Bush.
Yeah, I think so. I think Bush was a fairly delusional leader, and that was devastating to the country, and I don't know if we'll ever recover from it. But equally delusional were those of us who allowed things to happen, and that kind of falls squarely on every citizen that had any sort of voice or any sort of power during those years. And certainly people like Zeke spoke out against Bush, but we spoke to each other largely, those of us, including myself here, who opposed the policies of the Bush administration. We sat around and talked about how terrible they were and how much we, found them loathsome. But there was not a whole lot of willingness to change our day-to-day existence to
Right.
combat that.
No, and there weren't demonstrations in the streets as there had been, as there were during the Vietnam War. That change in policy, national policy, really only takes place when people get involved. You can
Yeah, I
see
mean,
that.
one of, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, go
No,
ahead.
that's right. You can see that around the world, where in countries which are really authoritarian, when the people go out in the street and say to their leaders, "This is not what we want anymore," even in an authoritarian dictatorship, the government has to listen or be moved. And if people don't participate and make noise and actually speak, then it's really easy for inertia to go on, or for the cynic to say, well, the government does need to change because they know no one's going to do anything.
Right. I think the moment of extreme delusion for the country in the Bush years was the coexistence of Bush tax cuts with trying to fight two wars. I think on a nonpartisan level, we have to kind of acknowledge that that was completely insane at some point. I don't know if we've acknowledged that yet, but you can't send men and women to fight a war at the same time you're trying to decrease the revenue we bring in. And even if you were for the wars, I think there had to have been some realization that you have to also pay for these. Preparing for war stimulates the economy, and we saw that in the Cold War. But actually fighting a war costs a lot of stinking money, and that to me epitomized the Bush years, the idea of slashing the income revenue and then spending a huge amount on a war. That seemed to be this, for me, the Bush years in a nutshell, those moments. And that's where I felt like we dropped the ball. We should not have allowed those things to happen like that.
Well, and it's probably, there's a certain cynicism built in. You could say that offering to lower your taxes at the same time as you're launching a war is a way of bribing people to go along with you. Because what you're saying is, I'm going to do this, you don't have to pay for it, don't worry about it, it's fine.
Yeah, and that's what they said to us about so many things, whether it was a mortgage or federal funding or state funding, or no matter what we were sort of taking in those years, each individually, what we were getting, what deals we were getting, there was sort of this idea like, oh, we won't have to worry about this. We don't really have to pay for this in any way, and that I think was universal. And so I don't think we'll fix the problems we're in until we acknowledge that we all sort of benefited. At least those of us with some sort of standing in this country economically continue to benefit from the delusional spending on it, some sort of level.
Well, so, this sort of leads to another, kind of sub conversation. We're getting away from the book, but that's
Right.
okay. I mean, you write nonfiction as well, and I saw recently you have a piece coming up in Orion, which is a wonderful, I would say, environmental, political, literary magazine. Maybe talk a little bit about what what you do when you write about nonfiction. What are your interests?
Well, the nonfiction piece that's coming out in Orion is fairly lengthy lyric essay about these very things we were talking about. And it talks a little bit more about climate change and this idea that we believe that everything is fine. And it goes into sort of a personal narrative of when my own family as a child was sort of falling apart, when my parents' marriage was falling apart. There was this mantra that was often thrown at us kids that was, everything is fine, this isn't for you to worry about, everything's fine, everything's fine. And that really is the national policy on climate change. That everything is fine, it'll work out somehow, we're going to figure this out. And so my essay in Orion kind of examines how you go about raising children in a world where that answer is no longer an acceptable answer, because it's not fine, and you have these little kids who are full of heart and full of joy, and you're going to leave them with a world with a fairly undeniable problem by the time they're my age.
Yeah, no, I think that's very right. I recently read that the city of Chicago has recognized climate change in their planning, and they're assuming that by the end of the year of the 21st century, the climate in Chicago will be the same as the climate is today in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And when you think about it in those real terms, when you say, okay, it doesn't matter, and I think it's safe to say, you know, of course this is caused by humans, but we don't care. It doesn't matter whether it's caused by humans or it's a natural occurrence. There's no denying climate change. The statistics and evidence are all there. So, but when you think about, you know, 50, 60, 70 years out, going from winters where you could be at minus 20 to winters where you're going to be at plus 30, that's a pretty significant change. And, you know, at Chicago, they're planting different species of trees today, anticipating that the climate will be so much warmer that you won't be able to have a northern deciduous forest northern deciduous species of forest in Chicago. It's going to have to be trees that now do really well in the swamps of Louisiana. To me, that's a really profound and kind of unsettling response, because it's practical and reasonable, but it also leaves a lot of implications undiscussed.
Yeah, it's stunning. I mean, it's just it's stunning that we're going to be the people. I mean, we are the people who are watching this happen, and it's going to be amazing. Here where I live in Iowa, we've had two 100-year floods in the last 3 years, and this summer I'm just sitting here wondering, are we going to go through this again? Because it seems to be that we now live in a place that's going to have epic floods. It's just that's the way it shifted, and the planning can't be, well, that was a 100-year flood, so we're not planning for it. We now have to plan for a place that's going to be.
Right, it means some towns won't be there anymore. Yeah. I mean, you know, this idea that somehow we're going to, you know, fight. This, of course, goes back to the idea that we're in a war with nature and that our job is to win the war with nature. I mean, that whole underlying kind of thinking has a lot of really bad ramifications for human behavior.
Well, that's my third book is all about this. So it's something that's very much on my mind as I'm moving to a new project.
Well, no, I think it's hard for it not to be on our minds. And I really actually appreciate the fact that you as a novelist are engaged, because, you know, I think there is the tendency to look at fiction as I don't want to say an escape, but as a kind of a form of social, psychological, artistic, cultural exploration that doesn't necessarily relate to the practical issues of day-to-day life. And of course, I think it does. I think fiction is not escape or, you know, I think it's as I said before, I think it's an indirect response to human issues. So, you know, if you're going to be alive today, it's going to be pretty hard not to be engaged in kind of political, cultural, environmental issues. That's what we're really living about. And I think fiction may have to respond to that, because the people who are fiction writers are living in the same world as everybody else.
Exactly. I think, I mean, this is how I approach fiction, is I usually do start with a character and a story, but at some point, the big idea, the thing that's keeping me up at night on a more sort of global level, I'd take a run at that idea with the story. You know, you go after it, and, you know, with this book, I had an idea and I took a run at it, and you know that there's always criticism that people feel you're trying to be more profound than you have a right to be. And I find that so offensive when people tell novelists that they have wandered into a territory of cultural or political critique that they aren't capable of pulling off. I find that to be sort of very strange, and almost a desire to make the literary novel something that's an academic pursuit rather than a real form of cultural engagement.
Well, so, or to make it even less, to make it more popular culture as a form of entertainment to be read and disposed of without actually having impact on people's lives.
Yeah, I think exactly. I think we're on the same page here with that. There's this, you know, there's this duty of anyone who's engaged in this culture to speak out against the things they find absurd or unjust, and do it in whatever way your voice sort of allows you to do it. So I'll keep doing it. I can't see me writing a novel that doesn't have some political and social criticism at the heart of it.
Well, but you, I like the fact you approach it with a sort of sense of absurdist
Sure.
view, and I think that helps. In other words, you know, that you can be serious and dealing with serious issues, but I think, you know, you have to avoid lecturing or kind of ponderous characters who you represent too obviously, you know, kind of weighty themes. You know,
Yeah.
then fiction becomes really just a kind of weaker version of nonfiction writing, whereas you know, creativity and invention that you display here, where you know this is funny and fun, and if you wanted to, you could just read it on that level. But clearly, you know, there's more going on, and I think the humor and absurdity is profound on some level.
Thank you. I mean, I've used a deliberately used a very accessible structure, which is kind of the structure that a romantic comedy or a novel that's classified as chick lit might use. It's, you know, Zeke trying to find love before it's too late. It's not structurally not at all highbrow, but so you can definitely read it as just a story of a semi-delusional bachelor who is starting to have his priorities shift and worried that it might be too late. And I think that those moments of shifting in people's lives where they reassess where they're headed and move into a mode of panic are profoundly moving and profoundly funny, unfortunately. And we've all had those moments where what we thought was going to work has quit working. And Zeke has had is in the middle of one of those moments. And at the time, they feel so heavy and weighted and fraught with danger. And afterwards, you sort of learn how much you've matured through that transition, and you can smile about how panicked and crazy and delusional you felt during
Right.
it.
Although I think maybe Zeke does not learn.
No, Zeke is joyfully going to continue as best he can, no matter what.
Right. He's sort of the classic happy idiot.
Yeah, he's back clearing brush on his ranch in Texas in a way
Right.
when the
Or
novel
right.
comes up.
Yeah. He reminds me of that. Oh God, there's like now, you know, I'm gonna blank out on the song, but there, I'm gonna be a happy idiot and pursue the legal tender.
Right,
You
you're
know, it's just sort of you feel like he's not gonna learn. He is who he is, but we can then step back and think about how, in what ways we are like him. You know,
Yeah.
that because I think that's where the sympathy, the true sympathy is, that you can see how you are that person who you're laughing at, so that when you're laughing at Zeke and his stupidity, or not stupidity, but the, you know, like this bullheaded inability to recognize reality, as you said before, that's really us.
Yeah.
And it's us politically, but it's also us personally. And I think it's everyone in that way. And I don't think whether you're politically left, right, or center, it doesn't matter. We have to recognize that there are times when we are living in our own delusion and we're just not able to see it.
Yeah, totally.
And so that's sort of maybe that's the human condition. And maybe in that sense, that helps explain this other issue, and that is why people are unwilling to accept change and act on it. It's partially because humans are not built for that. You know, it's not what we evolved to do. We
Well,
evolved to respond to the immediate.
it feels so good to be caught up in change and to be in the initial moment of change. It's sustaining change, which has been so problematic for the country. And we've done it in times of great injustice in our, you know, our history. We have been able to change things, but there's a lot more distractions now. And the more comfortable we are, whether it's the comfort of a Starbucks beverage or air conditioning or whatever, the more comfortable we are, the more difficult it is for us to sustain the energy that it takes to make the change after the change is made. So, you know, you look at the Obama election was this time of great inspiration for many of us that maybe we are going to reverse the course of what was a pretty damaging time for our country in Bush's years. But it was hard for, you know, for me and for everybody else. It's like, wow, now we got the work to do, and that seems as if we are totally tilting at windmills, and why bother, because my life's pretty good. I'm just going to cling to this project I have and hope that we don't lose funding for this project, and the rest of the world's going to have to sort this out.
No, that's true, and I think the critique there is that we are far too attached to our own little realities and
yeah.
not enough attached to the law. You know, people talk about their concern for the planet or their concern for the environment, but they're abstractions. And
yeah.
so they become easy to say and difficult to do. So there, you know, you write a check, you send a check to, you know, Greenpeace,
right.
or you send a check to National Resource Defense Council, and that kind of lets you off the hook morally and emotionally for these things that you know are much bigger. But I think that's also part of the problem, that we don't, when human beings were evolving as organisms, we were comfortable with the tribal size of culture.
Yeah.
And we can relate to that. You know, small-scale community is much more fitting for human relationships. So we break up into small communities. But on the large scale, we either state, country, or world, I don't think we have, you know, kind of the intellectual or spiritual capacity on some level to live in that way. You know, that great, you know, the great term, you know, think global, act local. Well, that's really hard to do.
It is. No, it's almost impossible.
So I think it's really interesting that, in a lot of ways, that this book launched us into this discussion. I mean, I think it's all there in the book, but I think, as we said before, you can read it on many different levels. So people who are hearing us talk about it, you know, I'm glad in a way that we're talking about this, because it means that if you're thinking about reading this book, you can enter it on your own terms.
And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of slapstick and sort of joy in the book too. I think Zeke is pretty exuberant. He takes pleasure in a lot of wonderfully simple things, and there are moments where he totally puts his foot in his mouth or does something wholly inappropriate that lead to sort of almost Three Stooges like chaos, you know, intellectual sort of overthinking. But then when he actually acts physically, you know, he's about to get tased by his neighbor, or he grabs his neighbor's foot while she's dozing in a lounge chair. I mean, it's sort of a book about impulse and a book about panic and anxiety, but it also is a comic novel to me. And at its core, it's able to also laugh at all these serious things that sort of like, boy, we've really gotten ourselves into a pretty serious pickle, but we did our best, and we can do better. You know, this is sort of what I thought at the end of the book. I'm not sure Zeke has changed a ton, but I think the reader might see some of the potential for change.
Well, and he's also, you know, he's not just a, you know, as we said before, he's not just a, you know, not just delusional. He also takes care of these two girls who are his nieces, whom he loves. And he has these two friends, these two, you know, the gay couple, who are really close to him and who really care about him, and he cares about them. I mean, he also works for and with some people who actually do care about him on some level. So
right.
he's not a completely, you know, lost in absurdity character taken to the extreme that, you know, you can't even see him as a real person. So I think at the end of the book, he's a sympathetic character. He's also could be symbolic, or, you know, structurally relation to all of us. But he's, you know, it's still a story with real characters who relate to each other. So, you know, in that way, it's not too Three Stooges or Marx Brother-y about it, so that you don't feel that everything is happening in this kind of fantastic place where it's all about absurdity.
Yeah, no, the core, too, is it's a guy who wants to do right by his mother, do right by his nieces, and who falls really in love in his way with the Starbucks barista, somebody who's forced at first to be nice to him, and that's the best contact he's had in a while. And he really does fall head over heels for her and tries to pursue her, and he just doesn't know how, and it's too late. She's caught up in something else besides him.
Right. Well, he does have that, you know, that's throughout the book, that he's just never going to succeed in any of his love affair ideas because he is so unrealistic.
Yeah.
In how to approach them. And of course, there is this one thing, I guess this is the last question I'll have for you. He also has this special ability, which is kind of there, and I'm not quite sure where to place it, but as he stands in the line at a Starbucks, he can look at a person and say what their order is going to be. It's kind of an emotional barometer of who they are.
Yeah, and, he can... Oh, go ahead.
No, it's all right. And he's able to name your order. And it's this kind of ability to, it kind of does go with his inventory of American unhappiness, because there he's being extraordinarily sympathetic to the to feelings that people in the, you know, that he's talking to have. He's really not, in that way, he's kind of connected to everybody in a really deep way.
Yes, he's very sensitive to strangers. He loves to observe people and assess what might be making them unhappy, and he feels this is his great gift. The trouble with him is if he really cares about the person, it's almost too much for him to take. So like when he deals with his mother or people he really loves, he can't really do it. But all of that tenderness and emotion that I think he has in his heart comes out in these weird, almost prescient meetings with strangers. So,
well, maybe that's another, in another way, where you've got this character who is really, you're expressing another American cultural feature, and that is our extraordinary ability to be sympathetic to people we've never met.
Yes.
And not take care of or understand the people around us who are in need.
Right.
You know, that's another thing you see, that, you know, people will write a check, they'll send money off to people who have been hurt miles away, but if they if a next door neighbor is in trouble, they can't do anything.
Exactly right.
Hadn't actually thought about that before, but that I think is really profound, you know, that you've kind of shown us a lot about American life in this really interesting way.
Yes, the misery of strangers is something we can help and then absolve ourselves about. The misery of friends and family is something that we feel pressure to do something about, and then we resist it. And yeah,
that's too much contact, too much depth. And like what we were talking about before, it requires you to actually do something, break out of your day-to-day life, not go to that, you know, not go out and see the movie or not have dinner with a friend, but instead take care of somebody who is in need. And
right.
I think that's hard for us. You know, we don't like having our daily lives, which are so organized and kind of automated, we don't like that habit to be broken, where we actually have to, you know, go to the hospital and take care of somebody, or sit down and talk to a homeless person and try to figure out what they need that you could help them do to make their lives better. I'm not saying everybody else is bad and I'm good. That's, we all do this. I think that, you know, I'm glad we talked about this, because I think, you know, I think this is a really good, I think it's really good to see this in coming from your book.
Well, thanks for picking up on that. That was one of the sort of more subtle messages I hope bury in that story. But I think most of us are like Zeke in the sense that the miseries of strangers are the ones we want to hear, not the woes of people we can actually help on a daily basis.
Right. No, that's terrific. Well, Dean, it's been great talking to you. I really liked My American Unhappiness. I might have to read it again now that we've talked.
Thank you.
I wish you luck with this book, and also with your next one whenever it comes out. This has been David Wilk for Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Dean Bacopoulos, the author of My American Unhappiness. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you.